On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and it is cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
The hour. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find a selection of news stories for your perusal on any given day. I'm back into my regular routine now. And, we've got news stories up on the website. Thank you, one and all, for your patience during my absence. We managed to get some broadcasting in and had a pretty good time of it, I thought. But it's just nice to be back in the home studio behind the home microphone with all the comforts or even the discomforts of home, because it is, after all, home. Let's see. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will, of course, find access to the stream for your PC listening pleasure or your Mac listening pleasure. The chat room entrance is also there, free and easy. Jump right in at your leisure. Folks are wandering by even as I speak. Jeremy and Sparky and Texas Betsy and Texas T are all in the room, and that'll get us rolling for this Monday. It is, of course, Moran Monday, but we're going to put the Morans aside for some really smart, intelligent stuff here in a few minutes, I'm hoping. I'm expecting we'll be hearing very shortly from a friend of mine out at the Rainforest Action Network. They have released their report card on the banks financing mountaintop removal and the coal industry generally. And Ben Collins is the author of the report, and he will be joining us in short order for that discussion. I think he knows who's been good, who's been extra. That's a short list when you're talking about investment banks. But he especially knows who's been bad and who's been abysmal and who's been just plain old-fashioned god-awful. Ben will be telling us about some morans that he's found. But we do have other morans, and I guess we could call this a post-Easter version of Moran Monday. And, man, talk about morans. Goodness gracious, if you were listening to the subject matter that Dr. Bill was talking about just before this program began, can you imagine? I mean, just stop and think about it. Just turn off the lights and sit in the dark for a minute and in dead silence just think about the horrors, wait, I'm back home again. Horrors, yeah, of a tea party called Teabagger Run, Americans for Prosperity funded, Koch brothers driven constitutional convention. That's enough to send you straight for the rot gut. But there's a possibility out there. Let's see if that makes things any better. Hopefully. Nothing changes while I'm gone, and yet I come back and the audio's different. Go figure. Oh, by the way, also at headonradionetwork.com, of course, also you will find the PayPal button. And I want to first off thank our good friend Dr. Allen with Waco Friends of Peace for getting us over a big hump. But we've got about a $350 hole to fill this evening. And we begin the evening with a challenge, and that comes from our good friend Robert in Australia, who sent a note earlier today in which he noted, it's Monday afternoon, April 21st, about 3:30 p.m. as I write this. That was about 1:51 a.m. earlier in the day. And he says it's time for my regular 20th of the month Down Under challenge. Well, Down Under Up Over challenge, but one day late. I'm putting $80 on the table, and I'll be very happy if someone or a group of someone's will match it. Signed, Robert from Oz. And you know how Robert likes for things to go. He puts it up, somebody matches that, and hopefully, you know, we crawl out of the little hole that we all too often find ourselves here in this little effort at independent media, independent progressive broadcasting. So the Down Under Up Over challenge is on the table right now. And for the remainder of the program, looking for 8 folks at 10, 16 folks at 5, 2 at 40, 4 at 20, however you want to do it, Robert in Australia is going to match the first $80 that come in. But now, as I mentioned to you a moment ago, we have on the line with us Ben Collins from Rainforest Action Network, an organization that does tremendous good work in keeping an eye on just how it is that, because you see, mountaintop removal doesn't happen because some guys get together and say, well, let's go down to Loco Joe's down in Goodlettsville, Tennessee, and buy us up a bunch of fireworks and blow up a mountain. It doesn't happen that way. It happens because well-heeled bankers in bespoke suits say, hey, why don't we throw a few million dollars down the coal industry rat hole and pretend that it's good for business? So let's bring Ben on now. He's calling from Rainforest Action Network. Good evening or good afternoon, Ben. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a real joy, and I hope you know how much I respect the work that you guys do, keeping an eye on these folks and keeping their feet to the fire. This is the fifth year that you've done a report card on the major investment banks, isn't it?
That's right. It's our we just published our fifth annual coal finance report card, which is a tool we use to engage with banks and get the word out about which banks are most exposed and most involved with financing the worst of the worst of the U.S. coal industry, including companies that blow off the tops of mountains as part of mountaintop removal mining, and also which banks are financing electric power companies that are dependent on big coal fleets.
Having watched this for 5 years, do y'all have a sense of whether it's getting better or worse?
Well, it's evolving. I wouldn't say that banks are doing the right thing and, you know, they're getting out of coal finance as a whole sector. But we did see this year, for the first time ever, we gave a B grade. We gave 2 Bs in our coal finance report card. We try to be very strict graders. We don't grade on a curve. But we did see that 2 banks took a big step. Yeah, I know. Took a big step away from financing financing the worst of the worst of the coal mining industry, and said, you know what? The companies that are most involved with mountaintop removal, we're not going to finance them anymore. It's just too much of a problem. It hurts too many people, and it's too much of a financial risk, honestly, too. So there were some bright lights, but by and large, banks are still up to their necks in financing the coal industry, which is unfortunate. But we're optimistic that as other banks notice that, you know, these coal mining companies are starting to go bankrupt, and there's a lot of risks involved with financing these very reckless types of coal extraction, such as mountaintop removal, that this may be the start of a trend.
Well, I was privileged a couple of years ago to participate in an action with y'all down in Charlotte regarding Bank of America, in which we called them out for their participation in mountaintop removal. And I couldn't help but noticing that where, and by way of preface, Ben, they were making a lot of ballyhoo, I guess we'd call it greenwashing now, wouldn't we, about how responsible they were becoming. But lo and behold, I checked the report card here, and I see 2014 mountaintop removal grade D-. I mean, that's not even quite up to the level of a participation trophy, is it?
No, and we mean every bit of that D-. Unfortunately, Bank of America, although they're not the number one financier of mountaintop removal mining, they're right up there. And while, as you mentioned, banks love to talk about all of the solar plants and, you know, energy efficiency retrofits they're financing, and, you know, we agree, that's great. It's really important that financing is going to renewable and clean investments, but that doesn't get them off the hook for their ties to the coal industry. Bank of America is a lead banker on several deals over the past few years with Alpha Natural Resources, which is the number one producer of coal from mountaintop removal methods. So, you know, they have policies. They say they look at environmental risks and that they are keeping a close eye on the issue. But if you actually look at the behavior of the bank, it's very much D-minus behavior in that they're putting a lot of money into this practice still.
But that's not to say that there aren't some Fs on the report card, Ben. What is, if as the author of the report, can you tell me what the demarcation is between a D-minus and, say, the F that BNY Mellon, GE Capital, that those folks got?
Yeah, and the difference between the D range grades and the F grades are, if you don't do anything, if you don't have any policy as a bank, if you're not even looking at the issue of your ties to coal miners or coal-fired power companies, and you don't have policy to address that, you get an F. If you have a policy that really doesn't seem to be doing much good, we'll give you something in the D range. And once you start making efforts to get out of the practice, you get the C's, B's, and A's. So that's sort of how the grading system works on the mountaintop removal side of our report card.
And let's be clear on this. Out of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, the 10 banks or so that are on your report card, you break it out into mountaintop removal grade and coal-fired power grade. And I don't see there are two B's on here. J.P. Morgan Chase, of all people, and Wells Fargo. How did they climb that high on the grade scale?
Yeah, I mean, for better or worse, those two banks are, you know, they're as good as it gets in terms of our mountaintop removal grades. Both banks in 2013, which was the year we were looking at for this report card, took very concrete steps to cut their ties with the worst of the worst of the mountaintop removal miners. They certainly aren't, they didn't commit to not bank any companies that were involved with the practice, but what we saw over the course of last year is both of those banks took big steps out of the real problem miners. So that earned them a B. It certainly doesn't, it's not quite A range, which is getting out of financing mountaintop removal entirely, but we see it as a positive, step, and we're hopeful that other U.S. and European banks will follow their lead.
And that leads to a second, well, a couple of questions here, Ben. One of which is to note that nobody gets a grade above C- over on the coal-fired power side of the report card. But lo and behold, the two Fs that you gave on the mountaintop removal side are the same banks that got Fs on the coal-fired power side of the assessment, namely BNY Mellon and GE Capital. Is it safe to assume that these two banks just, well, I'm trying to be nice here, don't give a hoot? I mean, they have no policies in place. They just screw it, we're going to support the coal industry until death do us part?
Well, unfortunately, you're right. I mean, neither BNY Mellon nor GE Capital has put out any public-facing policy saying we get that this is an issue on either the mountaintop removal side or the coal-fired power side. And, you know, even though when we give a bank a D grade, at least it's a step in the right direction in that mountaintop removal is a problem. It has public health impacts. It hurts communities. It destroys ecosystems. They're at least acknowledging that there's an issue to be addressed there. And similarly, on the coal-fired power side, saying, yes, as a bank, we have to be responsible for the carbon emissions of the electric, you know, the coal-fired power plant operators that we're financing, as well as the public health impacts of pollution from coal. And if a bank doesn't even acknowledge that, you know, yeah, that's what gets you an F. So it's unfortunate, but that's the reality with those two banks.
And secondly, you mentioned international banks, Ben. What I don't see any of them listed on this report card. Is that because they're doing better, or are they just are they in a separate class?
So, for the sake of consistency, for every year in our report card, we focus on U.S. banks and U.S. companies for the most part. So, at least for the grading scheme, we only are grading U.S.-based banks, but we do track the overall lending and overall financing that non-U.S. banks are providing. So elsewhere in the report card, we have sort of a top 10 list of, you know, the banks that are most involved with financing mountaintop removal mining or most involved with financing coal-fired power. And interestingly enough, the number one bank financing mountaintop removal in 2013 was not a U.S. bank. It was a European bank based in England, Barclays. So that was a bit of a surprise for us, and we've been asking our supporters this week to reach out to Barclays and say, hey, you know, we figured out that you guys are deeply involved with financing mountaintop removal mining. It's time for you to get your act together and stop it.
Well, let's drill down a little bit, if we could, Ben. What, first of all, what avenues are available to people who actually care about this issue to try to make a difference with these banks? You've just mentioned reaching out to somebody like Barclays, and of course, I would say that there's not there's nobody on here who is not deserving of, you know, some sort of correspondence saying you can do better. I mean, you know, when the kids here bring home a B, we say that's a lovely B. You're going to love it when you get an A. what all is available for people out there to sort of make their impressions known?
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, there's the opportunity to be smart and ask tough questions before you give your business to a particular bank. We've heard anecdotal reports from bankers at several of these banks that, you know, when customers write a letter, it's logged. When customers are, you know, demanding that they pay attention to these issues, they want to know about that. So be vocal with your bank. If you're concerned about the climate footprint of your bank, let them know, and if they don't give you a good answer, get your money out. In addition to using your own power and your own money, Rainforest Action Network, we do think of ourselves as a network. Our power comes, you know, not from, you know, the reports we write, but from the tens of thousands of people who we communicate with, who are part of our network, who are part of our email list, and who support us in calling out banks when we do identify opportunities to say, you know, to send emails to key decision makers at banks saying, look, this is a huge problem and you guys need to do something about it. So yeah, you can check us out. We're at ran.org.
Okay. Another question then along a similar lines. When these banks finance mountaintop removal, well, first of all, are all of these publicly traded banks?
They are, yes.
Okay, so that means they're on some stock market listing somewhere. And that means that, for instance, maybe you've got a 401k that's got mutual funds in it. And really, as long as the thing's making money, most folks aren't paying attention. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, they don't, the 401k guys, they don't make it easy to look at your, to really dig into your statement and see what's going on. So yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
So are divestment actions, something that has teeth?
Well, divestment certainly is a hot topic, and particularly with the fossil fuel companies that are the root of the problem, a number of universities and a number of, you know, public pension funds and cities and states have been looking into, you know, should we sell off our shares in, you know, ExxonMobil and other, and, you know, Peabody Energy, the largest fossil fuel companies in the world. And that's certainly an option, and that's something that you can also bring to your asset managers or whoever's managing your retirement account and say, look, I don't want to invest in these sorts of companies that are involved with accelerating climate change. What options do I have? And there are some investment companies that are starting to look into developing options for people who want to get their money out of the fossil fuel industry. And the more people who say, hey, this is something that I care about, the faster that's going to be an option. And on the institutional side, a bunch of universities and state and cities have already started pulling their money out of fossil fuels. So yeah, divestment certainly is an option, although our report card focuses more on the banking side. So what we've been doing with Bank of America in particular is we've, you know, we're in touch with a number of shareholders, and we've been supporting them in bringing a shareholder resolution to the bank, asking the bank to account for and report on its plans to address the carbon footprint of its financing activities, as we highlight in the report.
Can you speak to this is kind of difficult. I don't want to get myself too far into the weeds, but
no worries.
I get a feeling that this is all weeds, isn't it?
yep.
But to find the right words, is how possible is it for, say, a Bank of America to say, oh, well, you know, we're getting out of the, here's what I'm getting at. Let's say a bank says, oh, we're going to get out of mountaintop removal, and then you find out that they're financing the same companies that do mountaintop removal, but they say, oh, no, that was strictly the paperclip budget. I mean, do they play like that, Ben?
Some of them do, and, you know, over the years we've learned the hard way that you need to really ask all the questions, ask all the follow-up questions when a bank says, hey, oh, yeah, we don't finance mountaintop removal anymore. Because very often you'll get an answer, like you said, where a bank will say, oh, well, we only provide, you know, a general loan to this company, and if they just happen to use that money that we're providing to, for, you know, paper clips or, you know, dynamite to blow up a mountain, that's not our problem. So we're not financing mountaintop removal, we're just giving money to the guys who do it. And, you know, that argument doesn't really hold up, but when you put it on your website and say, hey, you know, we don't finance mountaintop removal anymore, you kind of have to dig down a little bit and really look at the actual transactions the bank is involved with before you can tell either they're in or they're out. And unfortunately, a lot of banks are sticking to that line of, oh, well, we don't finance it, but if you look in the fine print, they still do. But the good news is that a few banks, you know, as we mentioned earlier, J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo, they're actually getting out for real, which is a good sign.
And just out of curiosity, are you able to speak to who J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo were financing?
Yeah. one of the, I mean, the thing about the mining industry is it's going through a really tough time financially, with the falling price of natural, well, I mean, low price of natural gas, and other shifts in the U.S. energy mix. The demand for coal is down a lot. So the mining industry has been consolidating. So at this point, there's a lot of the mountaintop removal mining is concentrated in a few very large companies. So the two that we've been tracking most closely are Arch Coal and Alpha Natural Resources, both of which those two banks used to finance, but over the past few years have dropped financing relationships with.
Well, I want to share something with you, Ben, that just rolled into my email box. We just got an email from Jan,
okay.
From Jan over in the UK, and she just says, I will close the account I have with Barclays and write to the head office and tell them why. I'll let you know if I get a reply. And that's the kind of personal action you're talking about. I'm sorry?
Yeah, and the thing is, that's really great to hear. And the thing is, these banks, they're paying attention. They don't usually acknowledge, you know, publicly that they scrutinize emails they read from people or are tracking reasons why people are closing their accounts. But based on personal anecdotes I hear from people I speak with at these banks, you know, they really are sensitive about their public image. I mean, they've been dragged through the mud for about half a decade. They want to avoid reputational damage if they can. So they may not admit it to you, but they pay close attention when accounts close.
Well, I think that it's really inspiring to see that kind of activism just sort of arise out of these kind of conversations. It shows that you're making a difference. Can we go into a little bit of the kind of the minutiae of coal and mountaintop removal financing, Ben? Because it's been my experience when you look into this realm, at least from my layman's standpoint, it looks like something that's being done with a combination of a Ouija board, tarot cards, and a blindfolded guy throwing darts. I say that because, it takes a dinosaur gagging load of money to do this stuff. One of the things that we've learned is that mountaintop removal is very mechanized. It's not so labor intensive, so it doesn't take a lot of human beings working on these sites. Although $60,000, $70,000, even $125,000 a year, but that's a drop in the bucket compared to, say, Barclays' $550 million worth of financing of mountaintop removal. How are these things structured, and where does the money go?
Well, that's a good question. And the way that $550 million breaks down is these banks, when they put money into a particular coal company through a loan or another transaction, they'll usually team up with other banks. So rather than, you know, just one big check from a bank to a coal miner, there will be maybe 10 banks chipping in maybe $10 million each or to make a $100 million loan, which the company will then back in 5-10 years or so. And this access to financing is, you know, as you mentioned, very important for an industry that's dependent on big projects. It takes a lot of money to open up a mine. It takes a lot of money to keep a mine operating. And the financing that comes from these banks to an Alpha Natural Resources that's thinking about maybe opening up a new mountaintop removal mine is pretty crucial, particularly when Alpha's not doing so well. I mean, its stock's way down past few years. So it really needs this financing from banks if it wants to keep a pipeline of new mountaintop removal mines as a viable option for it.
Well, you just went exactly
right now. It's
I was going to say, you just went exactly where I wanted to go, Ben, because most people's impression of a banker is the very serious, upright fella at the corner bank down, in town, and or at least, small town banking, and the man would not say crap if he had a mouthful of it. You know, he's in the church pews every Sunday. He's a pillar of his community, and he's doused by the ankle in conservative financial policy every morning before he goes to work. What kind of banker would loan money to an Alpha Natural Resources whose stock price is poop and getting poopier? I mean, are there no standards involved? I mean, I'm sorry. I realize
that's
I'm using some
thing, I have the same reaction when you think about why on earth would you take a risk on a company like that, which, their stock is down around 40% over the last 12 months. Their credit rating, using the corporate standard, is well below, it's well in sort of like subprime territory. It's, it's kind of junk bond status. It's a single B rating from a rating scheme that goes AAA to single C. So they're, it's a very risky company to be financing. And the reason the banks do it is because when they see a really struggling company, they know that they can charge a premium to lend to it. So they can get a really high interest rate. And along with that high interest rate comes a whole lot of risk that the company could go under and won't pay back the loan. But, if you're a bank and you're publicly traded, you're not thinking about, is this company going to default on my loan in 5 years? You're thinking, how can I make my numbers for this year? And so that's why you have these banks that keep piling good money after bad on an industry that, is very harmful, but is also not a good risk financially, because they want to gamble on it and they see a lot of potential returns over the short term, and even though over the long term it's a bad bet for both the bank and everyone else.
Have you seen instances where banks have been burned in this process?
Yeah, actually earlier this month, and we highlight this in the report card, the James River Coal Company filed for bankruptcy, and James River was sort of on the brink of bankruptcy for a number of months, and they operate a few mountaintop removal mines, and they were actually looking to open up a new one in Kentucky even while they were on the brink of bankruptcy. We know in the report that, they had a line of credit from GE Capital and UBS, GE Capital is the finance arm of General Electric, and UBS is a Swiss bank. Right up to the very end, these two banks were providing credit to this company that, even though it was kind of barely, it was on the brink of bankruptcy, it was still looking to open up new mines and expand its operations. They're in bankruptcy, and those banks are going to take losses on those loans. And this is not likely to be the only instance of this happening. I mean, we note in the report that this has happened to other banks and with other coal companies that have gone under. So this is a very real risk that the banks don't like to think about, because, there's a lot of money in getting the loans out the door, but sometimes it comes back to bite them.
And you mentioned earlier bond ratings, Ben. In addition to just the straight sort of lending that maybe most folks think of, there are also bond issues, and don't the banks that participate in the bond issues get paid on the front end on the sales of the bonds as well?
Yeah, they do. And, as long as they can, when you have a bond, what you do is you get your group of banks together, and the banks will line up investors that they'll sell the bonds to. So whether these investors are, your mutual fund or you know, an institution like a state pension fund. They'll, you know, line up $100 million of investors, and then put, float a $100 million bond to these investors. So the banks take the cut, they take their cut right at the front. They get a fee for doing the transaction. They get the bonds off their books and onto the books of the investors, whether it's a pension fund or your mutual fund, and then they wash their hands of it. So under those circumstances, the banks are, you know, taking a cut, and very often of a transaction with a coal company, at least over the past few years, that is very, very financially risky, that they're sort of dumping on to other investors.
Does that make the bank's willingness to enter into more typical loan or line of credit agreements more palatable to them because they will get some of it back on the front end? Does it lessen their risk on the loan side of things?
I think so. I think what the way it tends to operate is the financing relationships are a package deal where the bank will get the bond transaction business where they'll float the bonds for a company. They'll also be involved with loan transactions where the banks are taking on a lot more risk, and they figure, well, you know, maybe there's a lot of risk involved with lending to this company, but we're getting a lot of money in from fees from other types of services we're providing, like doing the bond. So you're right that these banks, the bond money helps them stomach the risk they're taking on by lending to these companies.
And of course, with all of these banks, Ben, we're not talking about that banker down on the corner. We're talking about bankers in places as far away as London, Frankfurt, Zurich, Paris, Charlotte in the case of Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan in New York. Do any of these bankers or any of their boards of directors, do they ever get an opportunity to understand, either via the work that you and the other brilliant folks at RAN do, or anybody else for that matter, do they ever get an opportunity to come to a visceral understanding of what it is they finance? I mean, I know too many people who have sat at too many hospital bedsides watching too many people die who've lived near mountaintop removal. Do they have an appreciation for the fact that this is an existential issue as compared to some sort of aesthetic?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you raise that. Oftentimes, you know, sometimes banks do get that opportunity and will find that the way they understand the urgency and the gravity of the issue around mountaintop removal changes drastically once they've actually seen what it looks like up close and in person, and after they've met with people who have been impacted by mountaintop removal mines. I've been witness to a few banks that have agreed to visit impacted communities in West Virginia who are right next to mountaintop removal mines and have agreed to drive by mountaintop removal sites. To their credit, these banks it helped them understand the gravity of the issue once they were able to see it up close and in person. And with other banks, they realize that oftentimes the companies that are operating these mines, they'll tell the bankers one thing about, oh, we've got everything under control, we're doing a good job, we're improving on the environment, but then these bankers actually get to visit the mines in question, and it totally changes their perspective. So sometimes banks do get a chance to really see what it's like, and we find that that's far more persuasive than anything we could say to them.
I asked that question, Ben, because my own personal experience a couple of years ago with the Bank of America shareholder meeting was the opportunity to look at Brian Moynihan and say, after he had already announced that Bank of America was just going to go on and pursue their coal policies as they'd been pursuing them and the devil take the hindmost, was the opportunity to tell him, you know, that really saddens me because I'm going to get to go back to Appalachia and tell my dying friends that Bank of America is going to go on helping them die. And my good friend, my colleague, an inspiration to me, Larry Gibson, stood up and gave Mr. Moynihan, what we call around here, Hail Columbia, along the lines of the same issue. And, you know, he was in his own grave before in a year's time. And so I guess I don't know how we do it, Ben, but I'd like to see more of it. And I don't know, like I said, I don't know how we accomplish it, but I just get the sense that as long as Appalachian people or people who are poisoned by coal-fired power plants, as long as we are distant people, forgettable people, invisible people, that we're going to continue to have this problem. I mean, I can't imagine. I cannot imagine that Brian Moynihan would be okay breathing the toxic dust from these explosions if they were floating down on his house. And I'll warrant he doesn't live anywhere that could ever happen, does he?
Nope. And I think that the problem is that, like you said, the banks see people who are impacted by the choices they make as, you know, not being important. And it takes showing up to, you know, shareholder meetings, bank annual meetings over and over and over again until the banks get the message that, no, these people are important, and the lending and financing decisions that banks make have real consequences for health, for people's ability to live in communities that they've lived in, that their parents lived in, safely and have access to clean water. You know, it's unfortunate that Bank of America still doesn't get it. But what keeps me optimistic is that, you know, this year we're going to be going back and they're going to hear from people who are impacted by mountaintop removal mining again, and maybe they'll get it, because other banks are getting it too, and other banks are going to lead the way if Bank of America doesn't want to. So I think it takes a lot of repetition before banks really get it through their heads that, you know, the people who are impacted by their choices and their loans and their bonds matter, and that they need to listen to these people because they're really hurting communities.
It really is kind of and I hate to use any sort of eliminationist language, but it really is kind of a war of attrition, isn't it? Because if you can get banks out of it altogether, then the available pool of banks who participate in it have to then take on more of the risk, and when they take on more of the risk becomes more intolerable. Is that sort of the overall strategy?
That's certainly a big part of it, and another facet of that is that, you know, the financial industry and banks and financial analysts, they're all talking to each other, and there's sort of a consensus that emerges around what kinds of risks are smart risks to take, and sometimes that consensus makes no sense, like back in, you know, before 2007 when, you know, betting on subprime mortgages was like a smart thing to do until suddenly it wasn't, and a lot of people lost a lot of money. But market sentiment can shift very quickly, and a lot of the time, banks can hide behind the consensus of the market saying, oh, well, you know, everyone's banking coal. Coal's important. We're going to keep banking these coal companies because that's what we've always done. But you get enough banks to say, no, this is really risky. We're going to lose money if we lend to this company. And in the meantime, they're going to be racking up a lot of legal risk from water pollution. They're going to be harming communities, and we don't want to be seen as facilitating that. And you get enough banks saying that, suddenly the rest of the banks are like, well, what are we doing here? We're exposed, and suddenly you can see market sentiment shift. So we're hoping to see that shift happen as soon as possible, and we're already seeing a few banks starting to tiptoe in that direction.
Well, you went exactly where I was going next when you mentioned legal aspects. Now, of course, there are lots of lawsuits against lots of coal companies for lots of environmental degradation. Within the risk management structure and framework of these big banks, do they ever consider the possibility that someday they're going to be the ones named in the lawsuits?
Not that I'm aware of. But banks are looking at the real consequences of, you know, the real financial consequences of companies that are hit with big lawsuits or big regulatory settlements from water pollution and, you know, mountaintop removal mining. You dump the waste rock into the neighboring valley where all of the, you know, minerals and other pollutants leak out of it into streams. So it's a very risky process from an environmental perspective. And banks know that, you know, if a company gets too many lawsuits against it, it may not be able to pay up. And so they're probably not worried about getting sued themselves, but they're certainly very, very focused on whether companies that engage in mountaintop removal mining and other risky forms of coal mining are potentially going to lose a lot of money from it.
Well, I'm sure you're well aware, but based on the work that that I and a few others have done, and others more than me, there is a growing body of work that suggests rather incontrovertibly that the air pollution, the toxic dust that comes from the massive explosions that are necessary, the incredible blasting that's necessary, you know, the equivalent of excuse me, one Hiroshima every 5 to 7 days, the water impacts, that all of these things are contributing to a central Appalachian rolling health disaster. And there are precedents back in recent history where the harms became so obvious that it was impossible for financial institutions to hide behind any sort of wall of, you know, we were only shuffling the money. And I just wonder if that day can ever come where some sort of massive judgment can be transferred onto the people. You know, it's like it's a little unfair, but you know, there's if you've got a guy who's selling heroin on a street corner to school kids, that guy is obviously a big part of the problem. But somebody's providing him somebody's providing the heroin to him, and somebody's providing the money to provide the heroin. And in that context, law enforcement tries to go after all of them, and eventually they get to the point where they like to go after the money. And I just wonder if maybe someday that reality might dawn on some of these folks, and if that ever becomes a possibility, what kind of effect that would have on their attitudes.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, and I'm certainly no lawyer, but I would not be surprised if someday some smart lawyer figures out that, wow, you know, these banks are on the hook for financing all of this, and there's a case to be made against them. So let's hope it doesn't come to that, but we'll see.
Well, Ben, I tell you what, I really do appreciate the time that you have given us this evening. Tell folks where they can go and read the whole report, please.
Sure. Well, you can find Rainforest Action Network at ran.org. That's ran.org. And we have our reports page where our 2014 Coal Finance Report Card is located, and I encourage you to take a look. And if you want to stay in touch with us, we also have a way you can sign up to get email updates from us, and we also have a take action box on our front page, and I'm looking at it right now, where you can send an email to Barclays telling them it's time to stop financing mountaintop removal. So thanks so much for having me on. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the report.
Well, it's been a real joy. And please tell all my friends out there at RAND that I sent my warmest regards, and that all of us here at the Horn Family Commune Congregation do as well. And I hope folks will go and read the report and take action, because you're doing good work and you need the backup on it. So thanks very much, Ben.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, thank you. I certainly will. And keep up the good work yourself. And we look forward to having good news to share with you about banks and coal in the future.
Good, please. And especially Bank of America is coming up, right? Their shareholder meeting?
That's right. We will be down in Charlotte on May 7th for the Bank of America shareholder meeting.
Please ask Amanda or somebody there in the organization to check in and let us know how that goes, because that was an amazing time. I mean, when we figured out we were sitting in a shareholders meeting where there were armed guards up and down both aisles and plainclothes armed guys sitting within two chairs of us. You know, that's a sobering moment there when you realize they're willing to gun you down for simply speaking up about what's being done to your community. I hope it won't be that way this time.
Yeah, I mean, it was that way last year, and we're expecting a very secure meeting. It's unfortunate that that's how Bank of America responds to people who raise these sorts of issues, but, you know, we're certainly going to be there and let them know that mountaintop removal is still a problem and their financing of coal is still a problem. So, we'll certainly let you know how it goes.
All right, thanks so much, Ben, and have yourself a wonderful afternoon.
You too. Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Bye now. Ben Collins of Rainforest Action Network. They do tremendous work in the world of money and finance and understanding how you get from point A to point B to point there's not a freaking mountain there anymore. And so I appreciate them, each and every one of them. They've been wonderful allies in the struggle against mountaintop removal, and they are continuing in that vein. So go to RAN.org, RAN.org. Have a look at the work that they're doing, putting pressure on these banks. It is, it's a long and a tedious process, but simply doing what Jan just did in the UK, saying that she's going to go and close her account and that she's going to write to the head office and tell them why she did so. Jan's not the only one who can do that. I mean, let's go over this list on the report card. We didn't go through them grade by grade by grade, but listen to this. Bank of America, mountaintop removal grade, D-. I mean, that's like getting your name wrong on the SAT test, okay? 2014 coal-fired power grade, D. BNY Mellon, not even trying. I mean, this is not showing up for class. This isn't just not showing up for class, but standing outside the classroom and throwing bricks at the windows. F. Citigroup, D+. Mountaintop removal. Coal-fired power grade, D. GE Capital, well, howdy-do. F. They're standing outside the classroom chucking bricks at the windows of BNY Mellon. They're poisoning people to death and just plain don't. Well, hey, look, that they don't give us thing. We're another word that begins with F. Goldman Sachs, D. Not the good kind either. HSBC North America got a D+ in mountaintop removal and a C- in coal-fired power. So, they do. It is possible to tell that they. They know they can make a difference, and they know that they can improve. And they did on one side, and, oh, well, you know, that D-plus must have been a real bummer for the coal-fired side of the finance business. Hey, look, C-minus! J.P. Morgan Chase, sort this one out. Mountaintop removal grade, B. Getting out, but not out. Coal-fired power grade, D, as in dog. So they figured out that mountaintop removal might not be a good thing, but pumping a bunch of ultrafine particulates into the air so that, say, a 16-year-old high school football player in Cincinnati drops dead on the playing field because there's been an inversion in the river valley and nobody, yeah, haven't sorted that out yet. Morgan Stanley, D-plus mountaintop removal, D coal-fired power grade. PNC Financial, D-minus, D-minus. Oh, goodness me, don't you wish there was a principal's office to send them to? U.S. Bank Corp, D, D. And Wells Fargo, B, D. There's a long way to go, but every step that's taken is become force multipliers for what RAN does. This is powerful. This is power, and the work that goes into this. I've seen a teeny tiny little itsy bitsy bit of some of this work and what goes into it. And, wow, it is astonishing the amount of labor involved. And, you know, the kind of numbers where your eyes cross after a while and, you know, spreadsheets from hell. Yeah. So many thanks to our friends at RAN for this good work. And over in Europe, there's similar work being done and coordinated with RAN by organizations like Friends of the Earth, in France, Les Amis de la Terre. Freunden von, I don't know, in German. And my good friends in Germany at Urgewald are all doing tremendous work on this. So just, you know, be aware. Be aware. Oh, let's see. It is, lo and behold, we have closed out the first hour of the program. I'm sorry about... sorry about any buffering that may be happening. But it's kind of weird. Didn't have any during Dr. Bill's program, and then this program starts up, and buffering from hell. Bit of a paranoid out of a fella. A reminder, we do have a challenge on the table this evening. It is the 21st day of April here. And seeing as how the 19th fell on a weekend, Robert in Australia jumped right on it this morning and put out the up over down under 20th of the month challenge. He's offering to match the first $80 that come in toward supporting the ongoing efforts to keep this little broadcast operation up and running. And $10 of that has been met, so thank you very much to Jeremy and to Sal for meeting those goals. Thank you indeed. That means we need 7 folks at 10, 14 folks at 5, 2 at 35, 50 plus 20. We need $70 more to meet the challenge, and when that happens, that will take our deficit down to $190 to go. So it's a really big thing. So if you can help, please, please feel free to do so. Just looking for something here. There it is. At any rate, here at the top of the hour, we will take a break. Phone lines are open. 304-658-3333 is the number. Question coming in from Tim from L.A. I'm sorry, Ben's already gone, but Tim says, here in Southern California, I'm hearing a commercial for solar power in Wall Street. This solar power company is saying that the banks are now getting into the green energy and are leasing solar panels to homes like they're doing to abandon homes they stole from people in the power company, saying don't allow Wall Street to control your power rate when you can own solar panels. Tim wants to know, is Wall Street getting into green power and capitalizing off of the latest technology, or is it a marketing plan from the solar power company to sell panels? If Wall Street is getting into green power and as safe as solar or wind is as compared to coal, will the consumer, if they lease through a bank, get ripped off? Early in the conversation, Ben Collins did mention that a lot of these banks tout the fact that they are supporting sustainable and renewable energy as a means of, I guess, sort of trying to offset what they're doing otherwise with the coal industry. Bank of America, for instance, who is just awful about mountaintop removal, was touting the fact that they had some sort of a special in-house loan program for their employees to be able to purchase like Priuses. And that's greenwashing. But I suppose there's no easy answer to the question, Tim. But the way of the future is leasing. At least that's one of the means for people to go into solar without having to spend the $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 that it would otherwise take to bring it online. And remember, we're going to take a break, but remember this, if you go to the LA Times website, latimes.com, or you can just look over on my Facebook page, there was an article today about how the Koch brothers are not at all happy about solar and wind energy, and they're doing everything in their power to stamp it out. Now, if you're a regular listener to this program, you know we were discussing this months ago. But bless their hearts, the L.A. Times did just find out about it, and they did just put it in their newspaper. So kudos to them. But it is going to get harder, not easier, to go solar or go solar and wind or go wind or geothermal or any of the modern sustainable industry practices, sustainable energy practices. It's going to get harder. So if you're thinking about it and you can do it now, you're probably better off, but there is an all-out assault on clean energy because, well, personally, I think these attempts by, for instance, the Koch brothers, evil bastards that they are, these are the dying yawps of, say, really great damn big dinosaurs from a long time ago. And on the one hand, you go, hey, look, it's a dying dinosaur. I can't wait till it's freaking dead. On the other hand, a dying dinosaur is not a benign dinosaur. It's a dinosaur that in dying may become even more irrational than it was in the first place. And, you know, just start stomping things wherever it can. cornered beasts are the most dangerous of beasts. So just, you know, sort of bear that in mind. We will take a break, and hopefully y'all will begin popping the PayPal button. This is listener-supported Conversation Radio. Again, lines are open, 304-658-3333, and the Skype line is open. Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact that-a-ways. If you want to jump into the conversation via Skype, you are more than welcome to. Oh, update coming in. Wow, this is a big deal. Update coming in from Robert in Australia. He says he has changed. He has changed his challenge. He says, I'm changing my challenge to $175 this evening. Money holes are no fun. So $175 will be matched if you contribute this evening. Robert in Australia will match it, and that will eliminate the hole. Straight up, straight out. So that means there are $165 to go in the evening to, well, I can't thank you. I can't thank you enough. We can't thank you enough, Robert. That is stupendous. And again, thanks to Jeremy and Sal for getting us started. So light up the phones, light up the Skype line, light up whatever you want to light up. It's More Ann Monday on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
That's a pity to see when the land of the free turned out to be nothing but a free-for-all. If you got big dough, you're freer than most, cause your freedom goes up with the size of your bankroll. You can buy a judge or a bribe or a thug or a bomb or a shredding machine. You can buy your way through into and onto any ticket or TV screen. It's a money disease. It's a thing called greed. And it feeds on those who need the money most in money land. Oh, ain't you funny if you ain't got the money in money land. Now, corporate crime, you just do a little time, pay a little fine. And then you're in the clear. Murdering robbery calls the snobbery doesn't mean a thing. It just falls on deaf ears. Money is the thing we all sweat for. It's what some dreams are made of. But then there's those who want it all. And enough is never enough. It's a money disease. It's a thing called greed. And it feeds on those who need the money most in money land. Get a big house, fast car, honey, you've got class. What'll it get me? How much? What's mine? Are the only questions anybody seems to ask. Now, who got beat, got fought, got bled, and who got burned today? Who got fixed, got fooled, got framed, and who got in the way? It's a money disease. It's a thing called greed. And it feeds on those who need the money most in money land. Oh, and it's so funny if you got the money in money land.
Ain't That the Truth? Moneyland. The Del McCurry Band. An album from 2008. Curiously named Moneyland. An album well worth the having. And just really, really brilliantly put together. It's got clips from Fireside Chat. I mean, and you want to hear something? Oh, you want to hear something that'll blow your mind? Hear the Del McCurry Band version of the Beatles' "When I'm 64." Yeah, that's on there too. Moneyland from the Del McCurry Band. That's MCCOURY. Del, DEL. It is More and Monday on the Horn. And lines are open, 304-658-3333. But I sort of build this early on as, oh, my God, have we got Morans. You remember how much we enjoy Miss Teen USA's, South Carolina Miss Teen USA's answer about geographic illiteracy? You know, it features the words, but Iraq and such as. Didn't think it could get any better, but by God, just in time for Moran Monday, and with big thanks to my lawn mowing buddy, Dennis, in Kentucky, it did. Apparently, the Do You Have a Brain portion of the Miss USA pageant was, should evolution be taught in schools? And that's probably a little fair. I didn't mean to be misogynistic or sexist in that. No, anybody that answers this question, lovely evening gown or not, anybody who answers these questions this way, we're going to ask whether you have a working brain. So our Moran Monday nominees for the evening. Oh, goodness me. Should evolution be taught in schools? Dear God, if you're listening, Dr. John, please. No, you want the industrial strength duct tape. And be prepared with the second tennis ball in case you chew through the first one. Jeremy, are you sitting down? Yeah, good, good. Everybody. Moran Monday, oh my God, should evolution be taught in schools as explained by contestants from the Miss USA pageant? I've heard this already. Agnes ran screaming out of the room. I'm just saying. This is Sarah Chapman.
I think evolution definitely should be taught in schools. I think there's different ways to view evolution, but as everyone can probably...
Now, wait, I'm going to back up. I promise we're going to listen to this. But sometimes, with some of these answers, you're going to think, hey, not a moron. And then you're going to find out, wait, I was so wrong. Of course this is a moron. This is Miss Nevada. Yeah. Her name is Sarah Chapman. She gives us a little hope in the first few words and then just dashes them to the concrete floor.
I think evolution definitely should be taught in schools. I think there's different ways to view evolution, but as everyone can probably agree upon, everything evolves. We evolve as communities that build ourselves from scratch, and Nevada's a good example of that, that we've evolved from a very small community to something much, much bigger and much more successful. So I think evolution can be taught in many different ways and doesn't necessarily have to be about people and how people have evolved.
Told you. I mean, you can't say that I didn't. I mean, we don't have to talk about people evolving. I mean, look, cities, communities evolved in Nevada, and hey, Clive and Bundy. Okay, well, there went evolution. This is about as easy as it's going to get. If you can't take it now, run away.
But it can also be about communities as well.
Now, this here... Jeremy chiming in with our first quetch, Edith, of the evening. Yeah, I know. No, oh, but Jeremy, if you're typing, your hands are not strapped to the arms of the chair, which means you could conceivably rip out the tennis ball, tear off your clothes, and run screaming into the early evening. Careful there. Careful there, Jeremy. Now, our next contestant is Nikki Poteet. I'm sorry, Nikki Poteet of the Old Dominion, Virginia. Dazzle us with your brilliance, Nikki.
I think little bits and pieces of evolution should be taught in schools because it is a theory, and after all, we all need to know about different theories so that we can figure out what we want to believe is true.
Ain't she perky? Yeah, see, it's already happened. Note coming in from Steve. I can't listen. Once I heard the beginning, I realized I couldn't listen. I turned the radio down. I'll try to send you a note when you can turn the radio back up, Steve. But the radio's turned down, so you can't know that. Marty, keep going, Bob. Napa State Hospital has my wing ready. Wing, not room, wing. But, you know, Nikki Poteet, I mean, there's all kinds of different parts of evolution that we could teach. We don't have to teach all the nasty part about the apes and everything. And mercy, somebody get me the smelling salts. And here comes Kia Hampton from Kentuckistan. Kia is another one of those who's trying to walk the delicate tightrope line between giving a halfway sane answer and not having to go back to find out she's been burned out by the creationism clan down in Kentuckistan. Yes, Jeremy, I warned you. Bob, in the spirit of Easter past, jumping, Jesus Christ. I know. For me, Kia was one of the more difficult ones because I almost suspected she didn't want to be a moron. She wanted to say what she knew was right, but, I mean, this is the Miss USA pageant, and it comes with, the, you know, I mean, there's... Because money! You ready? Okay, Kia. 3, 2, 1.
I honestly don't think you can ever have too much knowledge on any subject. That's my personal view. But I do feel that evolution shouldn't be taught in school just because there's so many different views on it.
There's so many different views on it. Well, there's the correct one, the Charles Darwin view. And then there's the Ken Ham view, where Adam and Eve rode to a picnic lunch on the back of a tyrannosaur that was actually a vegetarian because it was before sin and before the fall of, before Eve ruined everything, you know, women. Oh, God, I got to tell you this just because bad things happen when I travel a long distance in an automobile and listen to the radio. It's honest to God, it's hard on the family. I mean, there we were, Agnes, me, Margie, Ferg, toddling down the road, and you get into these sort of radio dead zones in Appalachia where you can't even, I mean, even ESPN Sunday Night Baseball is coming in right scratchy. But without fail, when you get into the radio dead zone, it is a sure daggum thing that you're gonna... Oh, dear. Jeremy, he did strap his arms down. And with that one, I broke the other arm of my chair and managed to kick furniture, too. Don't go near the door. Jeremy, do not go near the door. That's all I'm saying. But in the radio dead zones, you will often get, I mean, when no other radio signal will reach you, religious radio will. And it is axiomatic that the religious radio that will reach you is not intelligent religious radio. And the unintelligent religious radio that it, and the looks from Agnes there in the navigator's seat, where and you know, Bob, it, click scan, but there's nothing else on. You've heard, we've been through the entire FM spectrum. There's nothing on. I'm not traveling with you anymore. Aw, honey. Think, consider this is like field work, okay? I mean, you're a nurse. This is like going in to find out why people in an isolated community are getting so sick. Oh, just turn it back up. And so this guy is trying to explain Easter, and no, it's not the fun Easter joke where Jesus comes walking out, looks left, looks right, looks down on the ground, sees his shadow, and runs back into the tomb and doesn't come out for six more weeks. It's not that. God, that's a great joke. I think it was it our buddy Tim from L.A. who posted that on his Facebook page the other day? I cackle every time I read it. Hey, so this dude, this religion industry dude with a microphone who is paying somebody to broadcast this over the public airwaves is trying to explain why it is that the women went to the tomb to, and there found that the risen Christ had gone walkabout. And he said, I like to think that it's because women are more communicative. They're more willing to discern the entirety of a situation and not just the facts as they see them. And then he went into this long spiel about how when he calls home to talk to his mama, he says, hey, mama, are you all right? And she says, yes, honey, I am. He says, well, I love you. I'll talk to you later. He says, on the other hand, my wife, she calls her mama, and they talk for 30 minutes, and she'll hang up the phone, and I'll say, how's mama? And she'll say, fine. And I'll say, what'd y'all talk about? And she'll tell me everything they talked about for 30 minutes, because women are like that. And that's why I think that women were the ones who went to the tomb. Because they would understand that the empty tomb didn't just mean somebody stole the body. They'd understand that he'd gotten up and gone walkabout. He was riz. A little bit later he told us the charming and uplifting story of the 8-year-old with Down syndrome who in Sunday school class, where he was constantly hectored by the other little Christian children because he had Down syndrome, they had a little project where the children are supposed to go around the grounds of the church and find something that indicated or symbolized renewal. And the children brought flowers and what have you, and new sprig of grass. But the little boy with Down syndrome brought an empty legs pantyhose egg. And all the children, all the good little 8-year-old Christian children, of course, berated him and called him names. And said, "You did it wrong. You always do it wrong." Now, bear in mind, this never actually happened. Preachers make up stories like this. And he said, "I did not do it wrong. I did it right." Opened the egg. And they said, "Well, it's empty." He said, "Precisely. The tomb is empty." And you can just imagine the little fundies out there dabbing at their eyes with their little hankies. And then the preacher goes on to tell the story about how a few months later the little 8-year-old fellow lost his battle and died, and how at the funeral the Sunday school teacher and all the little Sunday school children brought up empty legs pantyhose eggs and laid them on the altar for him because the tomb is empty. But anyway, so the guy goes on and on and on about how women are more communicative and more perceptive than men. And eventually I just had as much as I could stand and started sort of hooting in a rapid fire staccato, "No, you freaking moron. It's because the women went to the tomb to dress the body of the dead guy because the women were deemed in that culture to already be unclean in the first place, so fooling around with the dead wasn't a problem anyway because they had to go take a damn bath just because they had a period once a month. Good God, man, do you know nothing of culture?" You know, because, well, and this was all brought on by the whole idea of what Kia there said about, really? Her name was Kia? Yeah, I think her name's Kia. What she said about how they're all different opinions about what evolution means. Well, yeah, okay, there's the Ken Ham opinion, and then there's the Charles Darwin fact, and then there's that other opinion that God started evolution and then sort of let her roll, and then there's the opinion that fossils that were put in the fossil record by the devil to confuse the unbelievers. Oh, dear God. Let us continue with our morans.
So many different definitions. Like, how do you teach a child the true meaning of evolution when so many different cultures have their different beliefs and scientists have their different theories? It's just not a good subject that I feel everyone will agree on in classrooms when kids come from all different backgrounds, different cultures, different beliefs. So I just personally don't think it's a good topic for school subjects at all.
Yeah. Okay. Because after all, a child from, say, West Africa and a child from, say, Sweden and a child from, say, Japan and a child from, say, Bolivia and a child from, say, Canada can't all be taught science the same way. Because everybody's got different science. And, you know, in some of those countries, one and one aren't two. One and one comes up with a number that has to be taken out and stoned to death for having demons in it. F all. Busy. Jack in Shreveport asking, by the way, is Trump still in charge of that pageant? If so, I figure there might be a connection to the dumbfoolery. I was going dumbassery. I think it is, isn't it? Yeah, isn't, or is he Miss Universe? They get all run together for me after a while. Oh, thanks to Asa for helping out and chiming in. We are now only $115 away. Wow, thank you, Asa. We're now only $115 away from meeting Robert's Up Over Down Under challenge for this Monday, the 21st of April, 2014. Note coming in from Granny T in Tennessee. Thought of you this weekend. Heard a beautiful song written by Hazel Dickens, West Virginia, done by Robin Linda Williams. saw a PBS special on Hazel years ago, The Visual Songs and Her History Told by Her Own Self. I remember to this day. I'll add $25 to help meet whatever's on the table. Wish it could be more. I'll send it via the U.S. Postal Service. Well, thank you very much, Granny T. So that means we are now at $90 to go in meeting Robert's Up Over Down Under challenge. Thank you indeed, Granny T from Tennessee. Jessica out in out west, Jessica says, "Oh, Bob, stop. I love religious radio. I live for road trips throughout rural Oregon. Makes time go swiftly as I tighten my grip around the steering wheel and realize I'm going straight to hell." As an Israeli she-homosexual who calls in and tells these types that Jesus was a lesbian. Oh, I'd like to. I'd really like to be around for one of those broadcasts. Mercy. And so, it is time now to hear from Jessica Chukran of Alaskistan. Take it away, Jessica. Different Jessica.
I think it's necessary that evolution is taught in schools because it is part of our history and the belief system that the West has held for a long amount of time.
Okay. Hope springs eternal. Oh, my God. She wants to take... This cannot possibly be the end.
However, personally, I don't believe in evolution. I believe that each one of us were created for a purpose by God, and that just gives my life so much more direction and meaning.
Yeah, because, you know, us people who follow science out here, and by follow I don't mean believe, but I mean, you know, try to keep up, our lives are purposeless and meaninglessness because we weren't... And now it's time for, and you know this is just, I mean, this is going to be whoopee cushion good. It's time for Madeline Mitchell of, wait for it, drum roll please, Alabamistan. How could this not be drop-dead freaking awesome? Madeline, will you do the honors?
Evolution. No, I do not believe in evolution. I do not think it should be taught in schools, and I would not encourage it.
Well, that was simple and quick and to the point. Don't believe in it. Shouldn't be taught in schools. That's the end of it. And Constitution can just go to hell with all the other atheists and non-believers. Now, coming to us from the magnificent state of Talibandiana, it's time for Jillian Wunderlich. Go, Jillian.
I don't know. I think we should leave that up to the government. I'm not sure. I think a lot of people would have an issue if evolution was taught in school. I think we should just leave that out of the equation.
Lots of hand gestures. It's not your turn yet. Lots of hand gestures what was her name again? I mean, she really was more. She was more hand gestures than. Than speech.
And I would not encourage it.
Jillian Wunderlich. See, okay, all that science silence there, she's actually, and she's like making, like she's so confused, and there's hand gestures, and she's got her hands out, and why did you ask me this?
I don't know.
Every pageant has an I don't know person because they think that somehow that's going to differentiate them from the rest of the group.
I think we should leave that up to the government.
And with the government, we have a sort of Vanna White pointing to the squat concrete reproduction of the Indian god Ganesh for $500, Pat. There's a future for Jillian Wunderlich.
I'm not sure. I think a lot of people would have an issue if evolution was taught in school. I think we should just leave that out of the equation.
And what else should we? What should we? Yeah. Noah, dinosaurs, picnic baskets. You know the drill.
And on the third day, God created the Remington bolt-action rifle so that man could fight the dinosaurs and the homosexuals.
Amen.
You know it. Now it's Urza Khalidi of Idaho. You're up, Urza.
I believe that evolution should be mentioned in school. The thing is, it's all about what you believe in.
Should be mentioned in school once but not three times, or else Beetlejuice shows up. It's all about what you believe in.
And it shouldn't be pushed on you, but again, you should be knowledgeable about it, I guess. Just different options, because growing up in a family, you learn to live off of those values and morals, and if you don't have other options to believe in, that's what you're going to go by for the rest of your life.
That was actually kind of a half-hearted attempt, wasn't it? I mean, she almost said that maybe raising children to be superstitious fools is a bad idea. And from Idaho, no less. Angela Bird from Hawaii.
I think evolution should be taught in schools.
Yay! Wait, what?
Have creationism and a lot of other ideas and opinions that are taught to the children.
Okay, right. So we're going to teach evolution. We're going to teach creationism. We're going to teach an elephant standing on top of a turtle and standing on top of a turtle on top of a turtle, and turtles all the way down. Oh, sure, why not?
I think everybody should be able to have their opinion taught. However, I think it's the parents and the family who should be able to be there for the children to guide them.
Wait, what? Poor Jeremy. Poor Dr. John. Everybody should have their opinion taught. Yes, Johnny? I believe the world was created when a giant cow licked a block of ice from around the world. Okay, Johnny, that's every bit as valid as science. Thank you very much. Sit down.
And what their beliefs are as a family and as individuals.
And one can only hope that she will be every bit as succinct and charming as Ms. Madeline from Alabama Stan. Here's Paige Pinnock from Louisiana Stan.
I think so.
What, Paige? What? Don't go back to Louisiana, Stan, Paige.
You know, it's just, oh, God, that's kind of a tough one. Yeah, I think so.
How are you going to keep them down when they've done heard about the evolution? And now we hear from Angelina Kyle-Anon of Washington State.
I think when it comes to evolution, I think science is great, and when it comes to teaching, I think facts should be stated, and we should know the facts as to how the world evolves, because it does. But as far as when it comes to, like, little theories and whatnot, I probably want to stay away from those. I believe in the truth and truth only, not somebody's, you know, imagination or hope or whatnot. So I think facts, not theories, should be taught.
Oh, well, darn, that was just charming. You start out and you make me think that you got, maybe somebody taught you some science somewhere along the way, and next thing you know, little theories and imaginations and stuff. Oh, God. I feel IQ points just sort of slewing off me like skin cells under the shower. Here's Kaylin Reck. Or maybe it's Reck-A. of Georgistan?
I think that kids need to have a wide variety of things, not just be taught one or the other. I think evolution should be taught, but I also think that maybe the biblical stuff should be taught as well. You know, I think kids need to make their own decisions. We're smarter than ever these days, so, I mean, why not teach everything and let people make their own decisions?
All kidding aside, do you see here, and most of these young women are probably in the 18 to 21 range, do you see here what Teach the Controversy has done to this country? I mean, honest to God, I don't know what... Do civilized countries still have pageants? I guess they do, because, I mean, you know, you do you Miss Universe, and there's always a Miss Sweden, and a Miss Japan, and Miss Australia, and Miss Brazil. But let's say you were trying to get to the Miss Universe pageant in any one of those countries. Would you even have a fighting chance after 90% of these answers? I want to hear from Miss Recce again. Kaylin to her friends.
I think that kids need to have a wide variety of things, not just be taught one or the other. I think...
Yeah, not just science, but science plus superstition, and science plus superstition, and maybe a little magic, and a little conjuring, and some dinosaur bones planted in the earth's crust by the devil to confuse the unbelievers, because we're smarter than ever.
Evolution should be taught, but I also think that maybe the biblical stuff should be taught as well. You know.
Okay. How about the Bhagavad Gita? How about the sutras of the Buddha? How about the Epic of Gilgamesh? How about the creation myths of my friends, the Anishinaabe people? How about the creation myths of, say, the ancient people of ancient Mexico? Where the teardrops of the gods became the gold lodged. Oh, my God. Little Johnny and little Susie. You don't know what's coming at you out there, next generation. Oh. I hope nobody's shown this to Bill Nye the Science Guy or Neil deGrasse Tyson. They're probably just sitting in a room weeping at each other and drinking straight out of a bottle of 150-proof absinthe. And waiting for the green fairy to show up.
I think kids need to make their own decisions. We're smarter than ever these days, so, I mean, why not teach everything and let people make their own decisions?
Oh, here comes, oh my goodness, this is, here comes Ashley Durham from Tennessee, Stan.
I think evolution should be taught in schools. Personally, that's not my belief, but I think that all ideas should be put out there for people.
Well, bless her heart, she's tolerant. We're going to put all them ideas out there right next to the evolution. I mean, it's not like the evolution ain't going to be taught.
People should decide for themselves.
And here's Hope Driscoll from Missouri. And y'all be nice, no show me jokes.
That is such a tough one.
Well, at least she understands the gravity of the situation.
I think that if it were to be taught in schools, that would give kids a chance to decide what they want to believe for themselves.
Because we all understand, Ms. Driscoll, we all understand that science is something that you don't know, you believe in it, just like religion. Just like you believe in whether or not Muhammad flew on a horse that actually grew wings, and whether you believe that one of the ancient Hebrew prophets made the sun stand still in the sky, which of course means that the sun is revolving around the earth and not vice versa, and that the entire Copernican universe had been stood on its ear, or whether you believe, you know, again, with the elephant and the turtles and the turtles and the turtles and the turtles. Sure, why not?
So that way, if they learned about all sorts of different ideas, then they would be able to form their own opinions.
Does anybody get, in all this opinion forming, does anybody get to the look at the precious little tykes and say, now, one of these is a fact? You know, it just play that whole, one of these things is not like the others, one of these things does not belong, only it's reversed where everything else is bullshit, but science is reality. Does the teacher get to play that game with the youngins? I guess we don't get an answer.
Afterwards.
Now, here comes Brittany Thielman from Minnesota. And I bet you this is going to be one friendly answer.
Yes, I do. I think it should be. I grew up Catholic, so that's a great question if evolution should be taught in schools. But I think it's important that you understand all perspectives before making up your own decision. And I did learn from my priest growing up that evolution does not go against the Catholic faith. And Pope John Paul II did accept the idea of evolution.
Well, there you have it. The closest thing to an actual rational answer. And it comes from Miss Minnesota. Hooray for Minnesota. I agree, Asa. Asa with a note saying, Brother Bob, one could lose more IQ points listening to these people than one would lose downing an entire bottle of tequila in one short sitting. Well, that's the thing. You get over the bottle of tequila. You can't get over enforced stupidity. No. If you want to see, or for some reason that is absolutely beyond me, you want to see and hear again these answers, they are at restoring-. Please tell me there's nobody out there that spells the word hyphen in a web address. Restoring-sanity.org. Restoring-sanity.org. Top 15 worst Miss USA answers. You know what? I don't very often find myself saying that I hope this is some sort of a joke. I would love it if somebody would write to me and say, hey, Bob, you've been punked. This is not real. They didn't really. No. All the Miss USA contestants said, absolutely, evolution should be taught in the schools because we want to have a scientifically literate America so that we don't wind up being the ditch diggers for the rest of the world in the next century. Odds of that happening? Mighty damned. Back to the mailbag. Ron and Raleigh. Subject line, holy smoke! Bob, we're so done. The ignorance is simply stunning. What else do these pillocks want to be taught as a matter of opinion? They have to know the train of knowledge has left the station. Left the station, probably jumped the tracks. Terry Pratchett, another email cosmology. Terry Pratchett, in one of his Discworld novels, opined that there are many theories of creation and most involve stuff like some god cutting off another god's wedding tackle, which says more about humankind, or at least about religionists, than it does about cosmology. This note courtesy of Captain Mary in Memphis, who believes that the turtle moves. And the turtle does. The turtle does. Granny T in Tennessee. Damn. Just give them a bunch of timber rattlers and cottonmouths and see how that plays. I'm game. Robert in Australia, teaching evolution in schools. Bob, they teach evolution in all the schools here in Australia, the public, government schools, and the religious schools. And they've been doing it since I was in school. And I was sent to a Catholic school, and I was taught evolution because we have a federally mandated curriculum, and all students take exams on it. Church seems to be something most, not all, of course, people do only on Sundays. It's still difficult to comprehend why it's such a big deal, apparently, in the USA. P.S. Pageants, I suppose we still have them here in Australia. Not that you'd know about it. They used to be televised every year, but I haven't seen one for a few decades. If we do have them, we have fewer than in the past, and they're very small events. And I'm glad for that. Because the whole wholesale commodification and objectification of women thing kind of puts me off. Yeah. And a reminder, since we have finished with our morans, well, not all of them, but those 15 or whatever, phone lines are open, 304-658-3333. Skype line is open, Bob Kincaid Horn. And we are looking for 9 more people at $10 apiece, 2 at 45, 3 at 30. Any combination you prefer to meet. Robert from Australia's Up Over Down Under Challenge for the evening. We are only $90 away from a $175 challenge, so putting those other $90 has become... Well, it's a big deal, like I said, because, you know, the bills, they're always needing a paying. To the phones we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
Yes. Well, man, I'm still digging out from the 3 days that you guys were really locked up in some good stuff, you know, when you were down in D.C. Those guys, you know, when they've gotten to hell, they've got me covered with an area that I didn't pay too much attention to was the environmental thing that was going on because, you know, survival was what I was working on, like so many other people, just plain survival. These beauty pageants, they're outright disgusting anyhow. I know a woman who won in a local suburban Miss such and such, and my God, the only place you could get a job in a carnival eventually. But what does it mean, Bob? What does the whole damn handsomeness and beauty and what the hell does it mean? Look at some of the movies, the actors that we watched. Would you say that Bogart was a handsome guy?
Yeah, that's a tough call for me because. More the aura of what do you call it, the aura of machismo that he projected. I can't say that he, I mean, he had a paralyzed upper lip or something. That's where that whole thing came from where when he was a kid, his old man who was, you know, into beating the kids, I guess mashed him in the mouth or something. I've read that somewhere maybe. But...
Well, the story on him, his mother was an artist. And anyway, he supposedly decorated a baby bottle thing or a baby food thing at one time when he was young. Somebody better check me on that because these are things you get out of bios that may or may not be, you know, totally accurate. But it wasn't, you know, this whole thing that's about these beauty pageants are just, Bob, are these low IQ contests or what? Is that what it is? Or no
well, you'd like to hope they aren't. They try to bill themselves now as these are scholarship competitions.
Yeah, well, can they hire some a scholarship competition while also hire somebody to read it to them? And explain it to them? Jeez.
Well, the answers to those 15 answers don't inspire confidence, do they?
No, it just discourages the hell out of me, and I don't need any help. I mean, just get old, buddy. You'll be discouraged. But, I heard some awful good stuff last week, and we had a situation here in Cleveland just last night or in Lakewood where I used to live in a little suburban area where there was a big gang thing. And, of course, the first thing you hear when you hear gangs, what do you think? Inner city kids.
Yeah, what you're supposed to think. Okay. What the way they write it makes you prone to think.
But if somebody digs it out, it seems to be a bunch of kids that were into the underground rock, as they call it today, which is, I mean, I have a hard time with that stuff, but that's, my parents had a hard time with me listening to Chuck Berry, so I guess, you know. But these were like all kids. And there were damn knives and guns, and what the hell's going on here? I mean, that's a Rubicon there that was crossed.
Well, there was a news story while I was in D.C., Bill, about a house party in what was apparently supposed to be a respectable portion of town, where pretty soon people started, you know, via social media, hey, party going on, and it just snowballed, and then somebody showed up, and somebody else said, you can't come in, and the somebody who couldn't come in took a knife and, you know, tried to gut somebody, gig somebody like a frog. And it was all a bunch of kids. But I'm like you. I don't want to be that guy. These darn kids today, because I was few decades back.
Well, 1956, me and a couple of my buddies went down to a big movie downtown to see a movie titled "The Girl Can't Help It." And it was Jane Mansfield, I believe, was the star, and a lot of rock and roll performers, so you go to see that, and that was a lot of fights immediately after that. And Life magazine ran a series on some of, there were street gangs were big all over the country, and it wasn't, believe me, it was not racially segregated. You pick a group. The guys that, I did a term paper in night school on the New York draft riots. And the guys who really were kicking ass all over New York City and burning and killing were all Irish, just about. And all, it was, you know, lower social class. And they were acting out the things that...
Yeah, the New York City draft riots of the Civil War era, what was that, about 1864?
1863. Lincoln had to call on me to send a couple of divisions from Gettysburg. It was like 2 weeks after.
And who took
a week after they had been.
And who took the worst part of the new? Who got the worst end of the New York City draft riots?
The poor people themselves.
No, poor blacks.
Really?
Yeah.
The Irish, the orphanage.
The Irish focused their rage on people of color, and. And I don't really know, you probably know better than I, how that historically sorts out, but, the Irish were blaming them for, I guess, their perception that we wouldn't be getting drafted for this if we weren't fighting to free the slaves. Man.
Yeah, that was part of it, but it was also just the day-to-day job on the docks. The freed slave would work. He was used to being crapped on heavily if he was, you know, if he'd just gotten away from slavery. And so the employers would use them as to offset the other guys wanting a little more money. And the Irish were taking it. Let's go back over to Ireland and the potatoes and the Irish were growing wheat for the folks back in England. And they were living on potatoes. So it's this damn chain of events just keeps going and going. And I don't know, I hope that, because I'm in the environmental stuff I've been hearing for years. And I think, you were just saying something tonight about how some of the energy producers are now looking at other forms of energy. Because I always said that we will have other forms of energy once the money boys have figured out how to control it. I don't think they would like what people are doing in Germany, for instance.
Oh, we know they don't because, among other things, the German government has decided to back away from the feed-in tariff, which is what enables the entire Energiewende. But they were going to back away from it completely, but they got a whole lot of pushback in both the extreme north of Germany, if I understood the story right, and in the extreme south, where people, you know, people are really doing better with renewable energy.
Yeah, and aren't the people doing a lot of it themselves to their own homes?
Well, that's the way it works. A lot of people have it on their own homes, or they've got industrial wind turbines on their own land, and they are forming co-ops that then feed into the grid. And they, in turn, get, by virtue of the operation of that particular law, they get preferential treatment in terms of billing and in terms of usage. The stuff produced sustainably gets top billing. And in light of the fact that I think the company is named RWE, as Brother Albert told us a couple of weeks ago, posted a $7 billion loss in 1 year.
And when you do that, these people with the money still control things. Down deep, they can control it to the point where they'll put armed people against you. Well, then you got these idiots, these guys out west. Have you been following that situation with the cattle grazing?
Oh, geez, yeah.
Where they want to make a they want to graze the cattle on government land and then don't pay for it. You know, that's capitalism right there. You know, do something, make a profit, and don't have to pay for it. The bigger the, just make the profit, and the hell with everybody else. Yeah, I'm a cynical bastard tonight. You got to watch me sometimes, Bob. I just get
I prefer to think you're a realistic one, and I'm not going to challenge your parentage.
Well, thank you, because it's a damn thing. Bob, you and I are history buffs, and over again, no matter what the situation, the guy with the money kept wanting to pull the strings, and whenever they had to, they'd fall back on the religious leadership. Well, look at the, like, Cardinal Richelieu, you know, and people along that ilk that were the flag bearers and the waivers of the Bible in the face of the people, and you cover that heavy because it's used quite a bit to keep people, you know. I'm having a little bit of trouble with these guys who have been so helpful to me. They start treating me like I don't have a brain in my head, and I do not appreciate that.
Well, in situations where one is dealing with constantly changing technology, the safest thing is to make sure that one makes no assumptions about what someone knows about something. I mean, we've had ongoing discussions with experts, for instance, in electricity regarding some situations I've got going on here. And the first thing I say is, assume I'm an idiot. Do not assume any level of knowledge on my part.
I first assumed I was dumb when I was going to go to work on a car, but hand me the damn shop manual, give me an hour, and have the tools to go with it, and give me the hour to read about what's going on. Well, I was blessed. The damn electronic training and for television and such was up. And music, they kind of all intertwined somewhere along that line to have basic knowledge. But your knowledge of electricity is strong.
No. My knowledge of electricity, Bill, extends to knowing not to touch it. And knowing that when something behind me goes pop and I see that a plug has been turned black, that I got a problem. And then trying to figure out where it is.
Yeah, you have to know how much, like an air conditioner will draw 10 or 12 amps in it, or maybe a little less. But you have to know this kind of stuff or else you'll be fixing fuses all the damn time, changing them. Well, nowadays you flip a circuit breaker.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, you'll love this. While I was gone, okay, so here's how it played out. I called after a a power company guy went to the back of my, went to the back to the meter and pulled the meter and tested the voltages coming in off the line coming into the house. And, you know, he showed me, I saw it. He didn't just tell me. I got to look at it with my own little eyes. He showed me his meter showing that. His meter was showing that they were sending me 258 volts on a 240 line. In other words, two legs of 129 apiece. And the guy said, and the guy looks at me and says, "That's higher than that's higher than our tolerances." And I really think you should get it. You know, call him and get a guy out here to do a formal inspection. I said, "I'm on it. I'll do it." So I called him, and I said, and this was 2 weeks ago now. I said, "Listen, this is what happened. I saw the meter. It said 258. And immediately the woman on the line said, "We'll get somebody out there within 48 hours. Because she sounded like, you know, she was kind of concerned. Which the experts in the Horn family commune suggested concern was probably a good idea. So I called them. They said, "We'll have him right out there in 48 hours. Well, 48 hours passed. Nobody was here. But when, so at some point between hour 72 and hour day before yesterday, the guy did finally show up and left me the following note. You're going to love this. You ready? "Sorry to have missed you. Checked service at meter. Voltage and neutral checks were good. Electronics frying sounds like a neutral problem, but I could not find one on our equipment."
Oh.
Date 4/17/2014, time 11 o'clock. Contact person, APCO. No badge number, no identification. So where I saw the 258 coming in, he saw no such thing.
These people are liars. We've had here, what they did, a buddy of mine worked for the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, and they started buying out all the guys with a lot of clock time, a lot of guys who were experts. Guys who had been working, risking their lives day after day. My one buddy was on his way to a wedding, and he sees a crew working during a storm, and these were guys he worked with. He jumped out of his car and was assisting him, and wearing a tuxedo, and his great line was, "No wonder people were driving by and seeing me working in a tuxedo, and they assumed that's why their electric bill was so high." When you compare guys who wear tuxedos. Yeah, and the gas companies are along the same lines, and the phone companies, and because they own the power structure. What do you guys? Well, we have an outfit here that's supposed to be working for works under a state ruling, a bureau of whatever, and these guys are bent over backwards from kissing the butts of the power companies. I'm so damn cynical sometimes it bothers me, Bob.
I don't think that's cynicism. I disagree. I think that's realism. You know, scratch a cynic and
guys popping bullets at me. That's not cynicism. It's how the hell do I get out of this? You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you found it. In other words, they're content to pour the power to you. Is what they're doing. I mean, somewhere along the line, they're overpowering your house.
Well, I don't know now, because I sat there and by the way, somewhere along the line they did replace the meter with something newer than the old spinning pinwheels affair. This thing's actually digital.
Yeah.
And I saw with my own eyes the voltages coming in, and now this guy says, "Nah, they're fine." So maybe he looked at them when they weren't sending 258. Maybe the other guy looked at him when they were.
It seems to be in West Virginia that these companies maybe have owned the state since its inception. The coal companies for damn sure did. they've got away. I mean, one of the first things that ever made me think was a Folkways recording that got from the library. It was a woman from West Virginia with that great keening style of singing.
Well, that's probably
Coal Creek.
That's probably Hazel Dickens that that Granny T was mentioning a little bit, or was it? No, I think it was. I think maybe it was.
Bob, it was like getting slapped in the face. I mean, this was so vivid and so real that it moved me pretty.
I think
the thing, the music moves me faster than anything.
Yeah, the Hazel Dickens, I think, is who you're talking about.
I said, my God, you know, when she just started, and of course, you've talked about the disasters and hell.
Well, remember, I was going to say, speaking of disasters, just this past weekend, we passed the anniversary of the Ludlow Massacre, where the coal bosses sent their guns in and mowed down women and children in Ludlow, Colorado.
Yep. Yep. Was that copper?
I think it was coal.
Coal?
Yeah.
You know, they had some copper trouble out west.
Jeff Biggers wrote about it over at Huffington Post.
Because you mentioned a way of controlling money. There'll be something along the way that,
Yeah, it was.
I was playing a job, and
it was coal miners, Bill. Article in the New Yorker mentioning on April 20th, and so yesterday, on April 20th, 1914, members of the Colorado National Guard opened fire on a group of armed coal miners and set fire to a makeshift settlement in Ludlow, Colorado, where more than 1,000 striking workers and their families were camped.
Whatever it takes, they will do it. I was working a job in Lake County on a Saturday night, one of those hullabaloos, and people came in. They had been down in Kent that night, and they were talking, bragging about how they burned the ROTC building. And my first feeling was something's going to come out of this, because these SOBs, the power structure, aren't going to stand for that. And what happened, and that was at the, maybe the end of June, and the following Tuesday, was it May the 2nd or May the 3rd, the Kent State shootings? That was right on the heels of the burning of that building, and,
yeah.
I had a feeling that these boys are going to make somebody pay because they have the ability.
And
hire people to go do.
Right. When people start standing up for essential rights, the power structure will always push back. For instance, it was April of 1914 when John D. Rockefeller Jr. showed up to testify before Congress in regard to the Ludlow strike, and he told the Congress that it was, and this is a quote, a national issue whether workers shall be allowed to work under such conditions as they may choose. And then, of course, he blamed the obligatory outside agitators, meaning union organizers. And he said, they come in and interfere with employees who are thoroughly satisfied with their labor conditions.
Yeah, it was too early to start calling them Reds, huh?
Oh, no, I don't think it was too early.
I hadn't appeared yet in big enough, you know, numbers. So it was agitators, outside agitators. That was the thing during the civil rights movement, when there was a problem, it was outside agitators came in there and messed up everything.
Right, and of course, I'm sure the outside agitators in Ludlow, for instance, set fire to the women's infirmary, where the next morning they found 4 women burned to death and 11 children burned to death in a cellar, in a pit that was being used for a cellar. All 11 children and 2 of the women died.
You're familiar with the Bonus Army of the 1930s, that late
20s,
Four Roses. And here comes MacArthur, and Patton was in charge of the tanks they were running. And there's a picture of MacArthur standing next to Eisenhower, and MacArthur's wearing his goddamn jodhpurs, you know?
Yeah.
The cavalry pants.
Right.
And Somebody asked Pike later on in time, did he know MacArthur? And he said, well, not know him, yes, I studied drama under him. Because he was, you know. And you, oh, you talked about something about his father got the congressional. Yeah, he won it at Missionary Ridge when he was with the Army of the Cumberland. And you mentioned the Iron Brigade. How, Bob, the Iron Brigade was the first brigade of the first division of the first corps of the Army of the Potomac. They showed up wearing those black hats. Now, maybe a lot of Wisconsin guys were wearing those hats.
It's a matter of what they were issued. I was reading about them just the other day. But, yeah, they got, they allegedly got their, they got their nickname at the Second Battle of Bull Run. When they were, when they were guarding a gap, and somebody said, who are those? And, the response was given, and he said, those men must be made of iron.
Yeah, because McClellan jumped on that name right away and tossed it to those guys, and they were the first guys to run into Harry Heath's division at Gettysburg. I mean, first the cavalry was fighting. That was a great movie they made titled Gettysburg. The book Killer Angels was a piece of work as a novel. Like,
yeah, who was that? You know, was that Sharaw?
Yeah. In fact, I've got to try to get that one again because that, right on, I mean, it was somebody, a guy who owned a bookstore recommended it to me, a guy who knew me, a fan of the band. He said, oh, you're always reading something, so try this. And, you know, that's why I feel I've been robbed with the loss of the ability to read. I have to get everything. I just got A Short History of the Civil War by Fletcher Pratt. I just got that on audio after sending it to the site center. They had a volunteer reader read it. And I always laugh when I hear these guys making mistakes. I said, well, don't feel dumb, Bill. These guys slipped up when they were reading. These professionals were, you know, I'm just happy to be able to get the stuff. Because not everything that is ever printed is on audio.
Oh, no.
So I have to spend money to get it. But I'll leave you with one thing, because I think it's something that'll get you. During World War One, the British went to the big Welsh contingent of the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what they had them doing?
No.
Digging tunnels.
Oh, of course, because they came from the mines.
They had a ton of coal miners, and they were counter-mining. These guys would break into each other's mines, I don't know how many miles underground, because I don't have the book anymore. I can't get it either. And they were fighting it out underground, because the book title was War Underground. Is that human nature that it takes some skill? Well, of course, we have a crater at Petersburg that we tried, and that should have succeeded, but, oh well. Burnside was running the corps that made the attack, and, you know, you mentioned that guy's name, and, well, there's two of my favorite stories about the Civil War were two generals in the Union Army lent their names to different cultural things that we still use today. Well, Ambrose Burnside had the big hair whiskers coming down the side of his face.
Right, sideburns.
And
General Joseph Hooker.
Of course, the guy who took over. You got it. Because they say that out in California, when he was out in California, the area around his tent had a very professional leaning, shall we say.
Yes, once upon referred to as camp followers, simply became known as Hooker's women.
Hooker's women, absolutely. I didn't know you were that much of a Civil War buff, but you got
But I have my moment.
Anyway, I'll let you go, and I hope that we'll... But you guys had me going the other night, because I'll tell you what, I learned an awful lot when it comes to the environmental thing. I mean, I was aware of it, but I kept thinking, well, these guys aren't going to destroy their own ability to make money. Because if you destroy the planet, you just destroyed yourself, you moron.
But see, that's the problem, Bill. They don't believe in that. They don't believe they're destroying the planet. They don't believe that they're... And they're not. They're not. They're not destroying the planet, Bill. They are destroying the planet's ability to serve as a continuing host to the human species. And there's a big difference.
Yep.
But they don't believe that either.
I'm going to keep spinning.
They don't believe that either, because what they believe is money. And that's all they believe.
Yeah.
They believe money. They believe profit. They believe bonuses. They believe stock options. They believe share prices and quarterly profit and losses. And science can't get in the way of that. The only science they're interested in is the engineering that can make a gianter dump truck or a tire that's as big as two houses stacked on top of each other. And you know, those things exist on mountaintop removal sites, and God knows the tire alone is tens of thousands of dollars a piece. They believe in that science. They believe in the science of blasting. They believe in the science of earth compaction. They don't, however, believe in the science of stream poisoning. They don't believe in the science of people who what happens to people's lungs who breathe their godforsaken dust. They don't believe in the mutagenesis of living cells that turn into cancer, because the money tells them not to. There's that old line out there about it's hard to get a man to understand something when his wallet depends on him not understanding it.
Well, that's why the coal miners work their asses off, and of course under Lewis, I guess the wages picked up some, but you know.
Well, no, it's not just it's not under Lewis. It's and that's what's hard. It's hard to get through to some people involved in this struggle. Is that, you know, while you can point to the horrors of a Ludlow massacre or the Battle of Blair Mountain, none of that.
Blair Mountain, yeah.
I mean, public attention was focused for a short time, and in 1914 there was a public outrage over the Ludlow massacre. But guess what didn't happen? There was no change in the law. The Congress didn't do anything. 7 years later, they went to war against the U.S. Army went to war against coal miners in Logan County, West Virginia, and you know some miners were tried for treason. Not kidding. But nothing happened. Nothing happened until the election of FDR and the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, and that was fully a decade and a couple of years more after Blair Mountain, and another decade on top of that after the Ludlow Massacre, which was years again after the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. It kind of reminds me of the massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary, Bill, because, you know, here's the American people, and we were shocked and outraged when a guy with a weapon that he never should have had, who came from a house that was full of weapons because mommy was a hoarder and a gun goober, gave him access to them, and he goes into an elementary school and chops a whole bunch of 6- and 7-year-olds into machine gun chutney, and America is shocked, and then, nothing happens. Nothing happens until we pass laws. I mean, I'm not lecturing here, but I try really hard to get that across. There have to be laws. And that's why we spend so much. That's why.
And they have to be laws that are obeyed, and the guys that screw with the law go do the same time that I would get for snatching a purse. You know, or some other street crime. Those guys are the criminals that go to jail, and it's the multi-billionaire bastards that just sit there and count their money. And that's what has me. Yeah, I'm not the happiest guy in the world anymore, but I just, well, I had a call today that a friend of mine just kicked. That's happening a lot, you know. But my first wife did psychiatric nursing, and she had a problem with, it was called MD in those days, and it, which was not the type of wine either. They changed the name. It's more polite today, you know. Has to do with the North and South, you know, poles.
Yeah.
And you're standing by them, yeah. But I dealt with that, and she did psych nursing, and she'd come home from work, and she'd sit down and just unload, and that's one thing I was good for, Bob. She could unload all this stuff on me, and, well, another funny story, she had a shrink come to work who was European-born female shrinking. And she said to my wife, she said, you know, something's wrong with Mrs. Smith. She said she couldn't hear me because she didn't have her glasses on. And then she offered me a cigarette made of lettuce. She's really having a bad time, and my wife had to sit her down and say, I can tell you this, Doc, but one thing they do in this country is build hearing aids into eyeglasses. And there was a type of cigarette made of lettuce for a while. That's before your time, of course. They were still smoking.
Yeah, but you know what? I remember one time back in the 80s when one of the tobacco companies tried to introduce a cigarette made out of cacao bean husks. You know, the stuff that cocoa comes from, the cacao bean? Yeah, nasty.
It's the damn nicotine. I used to have those nicotine inhalers. They gave me those at one
time. I'm honking on a nicotine vaporizer even as we speak. I'm trying to quit smoking.
Yeah, well, good, because you were a heavy smoker, I know that. And I'm glad to hear your wife's name, because when she'd be mad on the phone when you were in D.C., she was a pleasure to talk to.
Well, that'll probably happen again in the fairly near future. Well, Bill, it's awful good to hear from you, and I'm especially after so long a period away.
Bill, my friend, I hope I didn't bore people tonight.
Oh no, you never do. You never do, Bill.
The tie-in with world history and human behavior, you can't get away from it, Bob. It just repeats and repeats and repeats.
Well, the problem in this country...
The blues is only the first line repeats once, you know.
Well, no, the blues, the first line repeats. No, the problem in this country is that you can get away from it, and you can get away from it very easily.
Yeah.
And you can and we are a people who are amusing ourselves to death, and, if you get a chance, go back and check out Dr. Bill's podcast, his replay from earlier today, and then make sure you're there.
I heard that today.
Oh, my God. Then you know. I mean, does it not just fill you with creeping dread, the idea of a bunch of teabaggers? And they've got their 34 states now. 34 states have called for a constitutional convention within the parameters set forth within the Constitution. As Hunter S. Thompson once said, the hogs are in the tunnels and they're going to travel on a road of bones.
Well, what broke my heart is we thought we had destroyed these people, the Berkshires. We thought we beat them to death when Barry Goldwater took the beating he took in 64. Anyway, you go on, man. Take care.
All right, you take care, Bill.
Talk to you again.
All right, bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. Onward we go. Oh, hey, before I go back to the next call, update, we are now only $80 away from meeting Robert's Up Over Down Under challenge, and thanks very much to Don for that help. So hopefully in the 31 minutes remaining in the program, we will meet the challenge in its entirety. Thanks to everybody who has helped out. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Bill, or Bob, and thanks to Bill. Thank you, Bob, for mentioning where you're at tonight on your on the finances. I don't think that's in your nature, but we do it because we all have to. And I'd like to thank Bill with his knowledge of military things. And it shows at Bill's age, and I pray that he's listening, for a man who was such, and still is, such a good musician, I don't think any of us have ever met a person that's considered a stupid musician. They're all gifted people, and they're all usually good in math, from what I always remember, as a person growing up around people that gravitated to that. But, I guess there's something I want to say to Bill. I don't know how to word it. The pressure that, your own son, Bob, feels, that you felt, that I felt, and how we respond to it, what Bill still feels, that you and I still feel, or when you go see a movie near Tampa, and you're a Navy veteran who created a SWAT team in Tampa, and then you shoot the other Navy veteran because he asked you to turn your popcorn down. We live in such a militaristic country. We paint it up in all kinds of different ways. We're a heavily organized militaristic people. And that includes the African Americans. So I guess I just wanted to say to Bill that I appreciate his Civil War knowledge, and I'm from Abraham Lincoln's hometown, and it doesn't give me any special privilege on knowledge, but I have an affinity for Lincoln. Lincoln served in a couple of skirmishes, apparently, in the Illinois Continental Army, whatever the hell you'd call it, with the Indians, and said the worst thing he came in contact with was the size of the mosquitoes. But Lincoln, like Mark Twain, also served in a couple of skirmishes, and he and his brother left and went west, young man, during the American Civil War.
A short history of a campaign that failed.
Yeah, and thank goodness it failed, because I think Twain...
Well, they ran out in the woods to be Confederate soldiers and in short order figured out that they didn't want any more of it. Isn't that the upshot of that story?
I think there's something to that, Bill, and or Bob, I'm sorry to keep doing that, and I...
That's okay. I consider it an honor.
Well, and I don't want to offend Bill. That's what I'm worried about. I typed it in the computer right before you picked up, Bob. And it's I ain't going to study war no more. Now I appreciate his knowledge of the American Civil War, and I know that that's going away quickly. And I think that there's people that served in the Civil War that wouldn't know what Bill does know about who served at what battle at Shiloh and how deep the blood was at what ankle depth and at Vicksburg or, you know, but what I'm saying is Confederate soldiers fought for geography. I love Southern people. I'm from the heart of the North, and I'm not a Northeasterner. I'm from the part of the country that, are given credit for probably winning the war, and we're not really, to talk about it, not that it was a taboo subject. It was just it wasn't appropriate to ever talk about it in a braggadocio or a winning way. It was inappropriate. Whether you're from Ohio, where Sherman and Grant actually were from, both of them from that state. Grant lives in Illinois, and after the Mexican-American War, petitioned the governor of Illinois to get his commission back, and the governor of Illinois actually agreed as the Civil War is just getting underway. The governor agrees to meet with Grant at some fancy restaurant in a hotel, and then they have, you know, their discussions, and then I'll see what I can do for you, young man. And he doesn't get it, so Grant stumbles down to where my friend Scott Summerhoff, who was killed. A Central Illinois young man who was killed in Beirut, Lebanon, with the other 240 Marines at Camp Butler. And Grant shows up in his worn-out tunic, his coat with no rank on it that had its wear and tear. He wore some jeans. I don't know that they were authorized. And he wore his authorized, as Marines would say, his authorized footwear, his boots, in other words, and so those were probably worn out like the tunic. So Grant falls in formation, I presume, as a humble person, whether you're a humble Southerner or a humble Midwesterner, and folks in the formation with all their bells and whistles and all their newly issued gear look at Grant and say, well, what are you? Who are you? What is that? And however he explained it, and they said, well, then maybe you need to go up front. So all the dog and pony soldiers and all the Sunshine Patriots pushed an actual veteran to the front of that formation, literally physically to some degree. And so what happens when you're in formations, of large groups of soldiers, people at the rear of the gear, as they say, a look at the people at the front of the operation right behind you. And there is some dialogue sometimes when you're waiting to do something more official when it comes to marching around or whatever. That's actually where I bobbed when I was at Camp Lejeune. I was in a formation as a decorated, probably Korea for sure, high-ranking base general was retiring. It's a huge formation. And thousands of Marines. In any case, that formation, I learned where there was a Marine in near me in this formation that he had been thrown in the back of a six by in Vietnam in a body bag, and he wasn't dead yet. And he came to consciousness and had to claw his way out of that bag. And so, you know, when you're a 19-year-old kid and you hear those stories, and the guy's telling the story like it was just like I had a tooth pulled. I mean, he wasn't bragging about it. It just came out. And you look at this, you know, you look at these leather dudes, and they're 36 and you're 18, and they look like they're 76. You know, in your mind, when you're that young. And, you know, so I don't see myself in the light of Grant, but what I'm trying to say is Grant, again, is pushed to the front of another formation. And I guess if you read about what Grant says about that, is he basically says, I was pushed to the front of these formations. I realized who I was around in his mind and what their experiences were. And I wasn't going to go back. I couldn't go back. And he turned out to be a good soldier, and then his wife called him a butcher, and maybe he was a butcher. But I would say in defense of the Southern Army, the Southern people fought for probably various reasons, all based on interpretation. They fought for the aristocracy just like the Northerners did, no difference. And maybe the whole war was a fought for aristocracy, and I don't think that there was hatred. Actually, there doesn't seem to have been hatred amongst the soldiers towards other soldiers immediately after the war, when you look at some of the old black and white footage that comes out from the 19th.
Oh, no. From what was that, the 75th anniversary or so of Gettysburg, where you see like 80 and 90 year old campaigners walking to clasp each other's hand at the wall there where Pickett's charge, there was a reenactment or something that took place. Maybe it was the 50th anniversary, but there's really grainy black and white film footage, and they're reaching out to each other, weeping as they do so, and it absolutely breaks your heart. And a lot of the foolishness that we deal with now, Mark, arose in the wake of that generation's passing, which is so often the case. You know, the real assault on things like Social Security only happened after the first generation to get and the second generation to get and live with Social Security passed on, because the people who hate Social Security could never have gotten away with it before they died, because those old folks would have gotten up in their face and given them what for. Because, you know, there's the, and so what you get is a bunch of filthy revisionists, who many of whom have never heard a shot fired in anger, and they somehow feel like they were cheated of something by virtue of the fact that the South got its ass handed to it, and they have been on a campaign, Mark, to do by other means what they could not accomplish by force of arms. And for instance, with this business of the Constitutional Convention being called by two-thirds of the states that Dr. Bill was talking about, you know, this has been a wet dream of the right wing, because it is the means by which they hope to dismantle the United States of America, and that is why for years now I have referred to all of this as a cold civil war.
Well, you know, Bob, and just it's like what Texas does, or Tallahassee kind of does. They have part time representation. Their governmental responses only report for a few weeks. In other words, it's just a provisional government. It's almost an absentia. It's a placation. It's an image of. But really, again, what we're talking about with the Cold Civil War, the ultimate agenda is to play into people's psychological interpretations of our own American history for the sake of privatization. It's always ultimately for you know, the
division. Well, wait just a minute, Mark.
Yeah.
It is also for the purpose of the retrenchment of that aristocracy you mentioned. It is for the purpose of putting back in place hateful things that tremendous amounts of blood were shed to change.
Well, that's why castles had moats around them.
I mean, remember, it was not that long ago that candidate Rand Paul declared to Rachel Maddow that he thought that the 1964 Civil Rights Act was probably unconstitutional, and that libertarian principles of business would simply have done away with Jim Crow and segregation.
That's a polite phrasing that you hear from less educated people, even though he's not an eye doctor. You know, he referred to himself the other day as an eye doctor. I think a ophthalmologist or even an optometrist.
No. He's an MD ophthalmologist. But being a freedom-loving libertarian, he didn't want to pass the boards for the National Ophthalmology Board, so he set up his own phony baloney BS ophthalmology association because, you know, freedom and because money.
It doesn't make you an eye doctor. I don't think is he technically considered? But you know,
no. I mean, he can fix cataracts and stuff. He's an ophthalmologist, not an optometrist.
Well, and
I mean, he's got MD after his name.
Well, and actually, there may be something to that. But you know,
although who in their right mind would ever go to him? I don't know.
Well, you know, poor Americans that can't afford American cataract surgery or radial keratotomy or whatever it is that they do now, the LASIKs, they go to Tijuana and do it for a quarter of the price and then jeopardize their lives apparently in the process. But I would just say that what you just described with Rand Paul is a polite version of what you hear uneducated Southern folks say. You know, that slavery would have taken care of itself. What I would just also just wanted to make a comment about Northern soldiers. I don't know, even though some of the letters that are written, I myself, it's like the founding fathers, and that language has been pushed on us in the last 10 years, 15 years. And I, you know, as a kid growing up, I was always intrigued by the soldiers with no shoes. I was like, shit, I don't know where that came from, and it didn't come from George Washington intimidating those soldiers. You can't beat a man into submission to make him want to go through a winter with towels or blankets wrapped around his feet with no socks. I mean, you can't bully a man into that. There was something to that, but my observation would be that the founding fathers all had boots, and I'm not saying their feet didn't get cold, and they had nice saddles and horses. But the men that fought war and some women were ill clothed and ill armed and ill fed and ill paid and not paid. And so those are the founding fathers, which reflect Professor O'Brien talks about the American exceptionalism. Those are the founding fathers of America. Those represent, you know, now half of our country, the Tea Party, they vote for the people in the castle that need the votes to protect them and don't even realize that's who they're voting
for. Yeah, the chickens are voting for Colonel Sanders.
Jesus Christ. They're getting Colonel Sanders' results. I just wanted to say to Bill that I love hearing about war, but I ain't going to study war no more.
Well, and you know, you've got a really valid point there. When you mentioned that, I thought of I can't remember what the context was that I was thinking about it in D.C., but I think about this kind of stuff when I'm in D.C. But before his own people killed him for what they deemed to be treasonous activity, you know, wanting peace, Yitzhak Rabin made the remark that, that human history is written in blood, and it is well past time we learn to write in a different color. And when I read that some time back, I was struck by the by the truth of it, Mark. And if you think about history, a great deal of what we perceive to be history is just the history of human conflict, you know, I'm reminded of the traitor Robert E. Lee, who said, what was it? It is a good thing that war is so dreadful, lest we should like it, love it far too much.
And Sherman's theory, Sherman almost lost his mind.
They thought Sherman was crazy because he said this is not going to be easy and this is not going to be quick. And for that he got what we would refer to as a psych referral.
Sherman had the solutions to winning the war so well in hand in his mind and probably written down, if I were to guess, that he also petitioned the federal government in some capacity, saying, hey, I got this solution here. I've got this figured out. This is how this can be done, and this is how it needs to be done. And he was neglected. And Sherman actually, I think, contemplated maybe even suicide. But Sherman obviously gets in the saddle again. But Sherman's theory also was that we have to make this so violent that it just can't repeat itself. And his theory ultimately was just, and that's where the Germans get the Blitzkrieg.
But the thing is, that's the same mindset that gives you Alfred Nobel creating a weapon that is so devastating that no one would ever use it against another human being, which was the motivating factor behind the invention of the Gatling gun and the expansion into the machine gun. The thing is, that mindset never works. It is never possible to create a means of wrecking human beings that human beings will not use on each other. Witness the atomic weapon. Okay? We're the only ones who have used it in anger. The world in the arms race has managed to nuke itself several times over, and we're paying a price that nobody can quite quantify or keep up with. But it's an unworkable theory. Until you can't make a war too horrible to tolerate. And the proof of that, beyond the things that I just mentioned, Mark, the proof of that lies in the fact that a whole bunch of godforsaken, un-American, traitorous, right-wing freaks showed up and set up sniper positions to defend a con artist who won't pay his goddamn bills in Clive and Bundy.
He's probably a millionaire, too.
I'm sure he is. And his family's nothing but a bunch of squatters and have been squatters since the angel Moroni was a baby.
And they're willing to.
And they want it. And maybe that's hard for a lot of people to get through their heads, Mark. These right-wingers, these teabaggers. I mean, we were driving down through the countryside in Virginia yesterday, and we drove by this house, and from way up the road, I pointed to the house because it had a flag flying outside it. They had an American flag with a Gadsden flag flying underneath it, and I said, oh, look, everybody, a jackass, a moron, a teabagger, a freak, an un-American, a traitor. I'm tough to travel with, you can tell. And so as we go on down the highway and we pass it, I look back. And yeah, it's this shanty ass looking broken down place with a goddamn Confederate flag hanging off the front porch. Now somebody kindly explain to me, and I'm not barking at you, Mark, you know, we're buddies.
No, I hear you.
Somebody kindly explain to me how it is you can fly the Stars and Stripes of the United States of America and fly that filthy, godforsaken rag of a treason flag at the same time. It evades me. And of course, you don't want to go up and knock on the door and just say, well, you know, I just wanted to look you in the eye. Because then they'll shoot your ass. Because, see, let's get this all the way down to our toenail clippings, Mark. These right-wing bastards aren't happy with the cold Civil War they've got. They want a hot one.
Well, haven't you and I, and maybe more so yourself, but I do call every so often in response to stuff that's going on. It's like the kooky veteran who wanted to have that march in Washington D.C. or in Maryland not so long ago. I guess maybe a year ago, whatever it was. But you're right. They do keep pushing back, and there's money behind these efforts. The man who took I just had a break today on my job, and I caught I was listening to Ed Schultz on a radio station out of Minnesota, and the man that stepped up for him today was talking about driving somewhere on the East Coast, Bob, and also witnessed some things that were like overt political statements that he didn't see in other parts of the country. And he was asking a caller what his opinion was of similar observations, and was he seeing things. He did mention actually kind of the Midwest, but he also – I got the impression he was also talking about the area you just traveled through, the Virginia areas. You know, it's a heavy propagandized thing, and it's almost like – and it's sad to say, it's almost like the Russians going into Crimea, Ukraine, where a lot of stuff is being done, you know, through propaganda troops, and then you have you'll have protests in civilian clothes, but they're actually Russian soldiers in civilian clothes. It's like when Saddam, in the second situation with Saddam Hussein, they said that the protesters that attacked that Saddam statue, they identified a good portion of them. They were actually Syrians, Bob, and they weren't. And they showed one guy in particular, was a real big dude, and he'd been a bodyguard for somebody. Probably a steroid dude, and they even were able to say his name and what he was. They weren't Iraqi, in other words. And so the American crane goes up there, and then the flag gets wrapped around Saddam's face. But they never showed Donald Rumsfeld over there selling him weapons on the behalf of Alcoa, whoever he was representing at that time, under whichever administration, right wing administration. You're right about the observation. Both observations go back to the same point when you talk about Yitzhak Rabin and writing a language in war and history and in a language other than blood. And we have the capability to do that now. Most of the world, I shouldn't say most of the world's not starving, but we have the capability to feed ourselves. We have the capability to do something about the future.
The problem with that, Mark, is that we have the ability to feed people that a capitalist system has decided are worth feeding.
Same with water and air.
Yeah, and that's all well and good as long as you're part of the crew that capitalism decides is worth feeding. But man, when the worm turns, it surely does suck.
Certainly.
I mean, here in Appalachia. We're marginally worth feeding, but we're not worth having clean air, and we're damn sure not worth having clean water.
Right, both counts, and they're both connected. And it is all profit driven, and so are the wars. You know, the wars are often they're never innocent, and I don't even though again. You know, I'm from Lincoln's hometown. It doesn't make me anything. What I'm saying is, there are observations to be made about our own American Civil War and banks and foreign country influences. Whether it was the British buying cotton, or the French willing to help whichever side in the American Civil War, and there were taxes. But you know, were the Union soldiers all opposed to slavery? Did they realize? I mean, if you talk to the average infantry,
those questions were asked throughout the pendency of the Civil War. I mean, that led to what were they called? The Copperheads in Ohio.
You had Northern sympathizers in Atlanta, Georgia.
Sure.
City.
Oh well, you had the fourth Alabama in North Alabama, who said we ain't got no fight in this. And signed up, and first they marched, and then they rode for the Union.
I didn't know that until I listened to your show. You brought that out, but that's a fact, right?
And it was far from a clear cut affair. But hey, Mark, we are out of time, brother, and I really appreciate everything that you brought to the conversation this evening. I genuinely do.
I know you do, and I just wanted to hear your voice in person, and. I ain't going to study war no more, even in Clausewitz or Sun Tzu. Sorry about your bad luck.
Take care, Mark. Have a good evening.
Semper Fi, brother.
Bye now. Our buddy Mark, not going to study war no more. Thanks, everybody, for a wonderful evening. Your emails, your thoughts, your phone calls, your participation in the chat room, your tweets, your Facebook posts. Thank you. That's what makes this such a unique conversational experience. format. It has next to nothing to do with me and everything to do with you. Thanks going out to Karen and Gary. A little note coming in. Gary and I just kicked in $20. That leaves 6 at 10 or 12 at 5. Come on, Horn family. We can meet the challenge. And actually 6 at 10 got turned into 4 at 10 by our good friend Thomas. So there's $40 remaining on Robert's up over, down under challenge. Robert with a note saying, thanks for everyone who made a contribution. Many thanks from up over, down under. And this was a few minutes ago. He said, we have 30 minutes left to completely fill the hole. Let's fill it and take the pressure off. Thank you, Robert. Thank you very much. Back tomorrow evening with Titanic Tuesday, which may very well have some carryovers from Moran Monday, as is often the case, depending on how much more goes sideways in the interim. I encourage you once again to join in and check out Dr. Bill's program tomorrow. He will be starting an hour earlier at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which is, of course, noon Pacific. Catch today's program, then catch tomorrow's, catch Wednesday's. I got a feel, well, Dr. Bill can't help it. He just opens the microphone and important things happen. We don't have a sponsorship that makes me say, hey, you know, join in for the ExxonMobil Dr. Bill American History Hour. That's not the motivation here. Dr. Bill is an opportunity to understand this country in a way you very likely never have before, and well worth the effort. So thanks, everybody, again, for making this such a wonderful return to the home studio. Thank you indeed. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia, to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org, who covered the stream in my absence. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT.org, ACHECT.org. It is through your advocacy that we will make the ACE Act a reality. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.